Let me introduce you to another family this morning. You'll meet them in the video in just a minute. The people you need to pay attention to are the little boy in the outfield and Steve Martin. He's the dad. Steve's been coaching his son's team. Team has done very well. His son isn't much an athlete. In fact, the team hasn't won any games yet all season. This is the last game of the season. On a couple of critical plays, his son was the one who dropped the ball. So it's been a long season. And now they're the last inning, the last out. If they can simply get this next batter out, then they will win the last game of the season. It'll only win. It's quite a moment between Steve and his son, the outfielder, that you'll be able to tell which one he is. Let's watch. Exuberance, enthusiasm, delight. Boy, you watch that little clip and you know a whole lot about that story. This is a dad who's celebrating. And in fact, in the setting of the story, it's entirely appropriate. It really fits. It's a big deal celebration because it's a big deal that happened. So much. He made it so much of that little moment. And that got me to be thinking. You may not respond quite like Steve does to life's events. But it got me thinking, what do you make much of? What do you really celebrate? What do you shout about? Not all of us, or perhaps not many of us, would cut loose the way Steve Martin did in that clip. But if I were to run a video of your life, if we were able to play a video of your life, I have no doubts that we would find moments of real celebration that is fitting for your personality, fitting for your temperament, fitting for your demeanor. We would find real moments of celebration in your life. And it is right there that something wonderful needs to be understood. In those moments when we watch you celebrate, we can determine what matters most to you. When we watch you celebrate, we can determine what matters most to you. Here's the idea. What you make much of, what you celebrate, what you shout about is what matters to you. You hear me? What you make much of, what you celebrate, what you shout about, what you revel in, that is really what matters to you. Whether it matters for the moment or matters over time or matters throughout your life, what causes a shout to come to your lips, what draws you to your feet, what stirs your heart to beat faster, what prods you to applaud, all of those things, they are indications of what matters most to you. Some of you parents, you'll be sitting and it's commencement time at graduation. And you'll watch a line of students cross the platform and you will politely applaud as each goes up to receive their diploma until your kid goes up. And then it's, yeah, and there's cheering and there's, what's going on? Well, you're politely celebrating with the others, but what really matters to you is that your little Einstein made it across the platform. You nod and you smile when the other team scores a great goal in the championship game. How did they pull? That was just an amazing, and you don't diss them, you don't boo, you politely cheer. But then, when your team pulls it out in the last seconds of that championship game, you can't keep your seat. You are on your feet. You're cheering with everybody else, and that is right, and that is proper, and that's appropriate. It only makes sense to make much of what matters most to you. That makes sense. You should make much of what matters most to you. And it's understanding this that forms the framework for our understanding the magnitude of what Paul is going to drive home to us in the closing chapter here in Galatians. We've been in a series on Galatians for quite some time, working our way through this marvelous presentation of Paul's message of the gospel. And he's been talking about what the gospel is, and about grace, and about freedom, and about what Jesus has done, and what the Spirit is doing, and about entering in and enjoying life, not just coming to know God, but experiencing life with Him. And Paul has been vigorous in his presentation of the gospel, and just as vigorous in his opposition of anything that would distract us from this great good news. He began in the early chapters of Galatians to lay out his theological understanding as he talked about justification and rescue. And then in the middle chapters, he anchored that really well to the biblical text. The Old Testament thinking about how does someone have life with God, anchoring his thinking about our life in the life of Abraham and Old Testament examples. And then in the closing chapters, 5 and 6, he's been offering, I guess, what some would call the practical implications. But for Paul, the practical implications, it's not just he finishes what he really wants to talk about, now he just gives us a list of things to do. The practical implications in chapters 5 and 6 flow out of his theology. He lives this way because he believes these things. And so in the closing chapters, he is still talking about the one same thing. He's not changed topics. He is still exploring the implications of what Jesus did on the cross for our lives and what bearing that has on this life that we have through the Spirit, this life that is better than we can imagine and more wonderful than we deserve. That's Paul's Galatian theme, and he's just bringing that home in these last few verses. What we've seen recently, over the past few weeks, is that the gospel, this relationship that I have with God through the work of Christ in the power of the Spirit, changes everything. It impacts all of my life, and every relationship that I have is changed by the gospel. And now we have just a few sessions before we close this book. And here, this morning, we're going to get a little bit of insight into what's closest to Paul's heart. It's going to be the summation, in a sense, of what he's been saying. In order to get that, let's pause to pray for just a minute, and then we'll read. Lord, it's not enough to merely get the thought. I want us to be able to enter into the spirit, the heart, the sense, the soul of Paul as we read this passage. Paul didn't write the words just for information. He really was inviting the Galatians into his kind of life, and that's what we want. We don't want to just know about life. We would like to really experience the kind of life that you offer us. So this morning I'm asking, Sovereign God, please work in this place because of the cross and because of what Jesus has done and because of the gospel. In the power of the Spirit and by your word, would you please grip us in a fresh and deep and marvelous way with the heart of Paul that reflects the heart of Christ, that reflects the heart of the Spirit, that reflects your own heart, Father, towards us, and help us to get it, to see it, to enter it, to live there. Meet with us and open our minds and our hearts and our eyes and our ears and speak to us through your word that you might receive the glory that is rightly yours. That's my prayer. In Jesus' name, amen. Galatians chapter 6, just a few verses. I'm going to start in verse 11, read a few verses, then we'll come back and talk it through. As he draws this letter to a close, this is what he writes. See with what large letters I am writing to you with my own hand. It is those who want to make a good showing in the flesh who would force you to be circumcised, and only in order that they may not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. For even those who are circumcised do not themselves keep the law, but they desire to have you circumcised that they may boast in your flesh. But far be it from me to boast except in the cross of Christ, our Lord Jesus, the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by which the world has been crucified to me and I to the world. For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. Now, Paul starts this little section in the letter with those words about "with my own hand." What's he referring to there? Paul, often when he gave a letter, he would dictate it, and he'd have a companion of his, an amanuensis, a scribe, write it out. And that way he'd be able to freely speak, and they would write, and the letter would be sent. And occasionally, like in the end of 1 Thessalonians, Paul adds a word in his own hand. At the end of 1 Thessalonians, he says, I'm writing this sentence myself. And he seems to be saying that same kind of thing here in Galatians 6:11 when he says, notice with what large letters I'm writing. The idea may well be that my handwriting is not nearly as nice as the professional scribes. You can see that this is my handwriting. Two views taken on that. Some think that what Paul is saying is that from 6:11 on, he wrote that. That's a popular view. In fact, a lot of commentators would take that approach. The language that Paul uses, though, to talk about having written in these large letters suggests that maybe it was the whole letter of Galatians that Paul actually penned by himself. Whichever way you come out on it, one of the things that you have to really understand is that what we're about to read is really Paul's heart. I mean, it's not like when you read the rest of his letters that you miss what he is saying. It's come through some interpreter. No, that's not the case. But Paul is, in a sense, there's no way to underline or make it bold or italics when you're manuscripting a message, when you're just writing it out by hand. And so this is Paul's way of underlining this, underscoring. Make sure you get this. This is really what I'm all about. This is what you really have to hear. So whether you see it all of Galatians or just this end part, what we're about to read, Paul wants us to make sure we're really clear on this is what he is really all about. Paul has been, in this letter, been talking about two different kinds of life. Two different approaches to life, and he wants to clarify this even one more time. On one end, there's natural living. Natural living is just what people have, biological existence and the way that they carry on their lives. And Paul says, well, there's something other than natural living, and he says, because of the gospel, there's supernatural living. And so in this letter, he's been contrasting two different ways of living. There's natural living and there's supernatural living. And talking about natural living, he'll use the word flesh to talk about natural living. That doesn't mean your most sinful self. You know, flesh just means humanness. So he talks about the kind of life you can live in your humanness, or he says there's life in the Spirit, the kind of life that the Spirit of God gives you. So he contrasts that natural living and supernatural living, flesh and spirit. He makes other contrasts in this letter. Over here, this is all about works. Works, that's what you can do on your own. Effort, energy, you get to do works. That's life in the flesh. That's natural. Sure, we'd expect that of you. You could do that. That's works. That's natural living. On this side, it's not about works. This is about fruit of the Spirit. Fruit of the Spirit. The stuff seen in your life that you're not responsible for. You didn't make happen. The Spirit of God produced that in you. This side, supernatural living, this is the Spirit. This is fruit. That side, that's natural living. That's flesh. That's works. This is, on this side, this is rules. This is life on the basis of rules, law. That side, that's grace. This is grace, free gift of life. On this side, it's death. On this side, it's life. On this side, it's all about what you can do and how much you should do. On that side, it's all about what Jesus did and how much he's continuing to do. And so Paul has been offering to us throughout Galatians this contrast, and now he comes to this, for me, a startling kind of contrast. He is telling us that these two ways of living are evident because of what they boast about. He says you can tell the kind of life based on the boasting. Now, when you think about boasting, you might be thinking about the way that it's often used when we think it's someone's bragging, you know, where their ego gets in the way. And so boasting, the word may have a kind of negative connotation. But the word itself isn't negative. The word itself simply means to be joyously, exuberantly reveling in. It's just a good word about what you sell, in a sense, what you make much of. You boast. What you make much of, what you celebrate, what you shout about. Boast is a vocal, exuberant participation in. That's boasting. John Stott, talking about this word out of Galatians, says, boasting, you boast about what fills your horizon, what engrosses your attention, what absorbs your time and energy. It's what you revel in. It's what you celebrate. That's what boasting is about. And what Paul is telling us in this passage is that there's this contrast, two different kinds of boasting. And first he starts with the Judaizers, the legalists, the rule keepers. He says they're living for one thing, one way. And did you hear his description? He says that those who want to make a good showing in the flesh, the legalists, the rule keepers. Now, he's not saying they'd like to be as sinful as they possibly can be. That's not what he means, to make a good showing in the flesh. He says they just want to naturally look good. They want to look good on the basis of what they can do, what they can produce, what they can manufacture, what they can manufacture in the lives of others. They're all about passing on the rules that they're living by to get others to be involved in the rule-keeping game also. And Paul says they do that for two reasons. The legalist, the rule-keeper, lives with the rules and wants to get others involved in the rules for two reasons. The first reason, he says, is so that, here's how he says it, it is those who want to make a good showing in the flesh who would force you to be circumcised, and only in order that they not be persecuted for the cross of Christ. What's he saying there? Well, when Paul talks about the cross of Christ, he's not talking about the piece of wood. You know that. When he's talking about the cross of Christ, he's talking about the work of Christ. He's talking about all that Jesus has done. Jesus coming into the world to be the servant, to serve both God and man, to be the substitute, to die on that cross in our place, and to rise and present us holy before God and send the Spirit. The cross of Christ is Paul's shorthand for talking about all of the work of Christ. And he says that those who want to make a good showing in the flesh, that is, want to just look good naturally, he says part of the reason why they do that is so that they cannot be, so they will not be persecuted because of the cross. What does it mean when he says that they don't want to be persecuted because of the cross? Well, the cross is an offensive message, not just in Paul's day, but in our day. Because at the heart of the message of the cross is this simple word, this simple idea. You don't contribute a thing to this. You don't contribute a thing to this. You mean by standing before God, I don't deserve that? No. I can't earn that? Nope. Can I add something to it? Not a thing. If you have right standing with God and life with God, it is all because of what Jesus did on the cross. And that's an offensive message, particularly to those who live by the rules. And so what was going on is that when Paul was going and preaching the gospel, some who had come to know Jesus but also lived with a boatload of rules, they'd follow along Paul. And they'd see Paul telling people it wasn't about the rules, it was about Jesus. And that troubled them. And those rule keepers were persecuting these gospel hearers. So the false teachers were coming in and saying, okay, we can solve this. We can resolve the tension here. We will affirm it's good to believe in Jesus. That will make Paul happy. And then we'll say all you have to do is add rules, and that'll keep us from being persecuted by the rule keepers back home. So Paul says that the rule keepers are living the way that they do to avoid the problem of the cross. But then he says there's something else too. Did you notice what he says they boast in? He says, although they don't fully keep the law themselves, we already know that nobody does. He says, the reason why they do this is so that they can boast in your flesh. Now, you've got to be careful how you read that, because sometimes in church settings when we talk about flesh, we think that means sinfulness. Well, obviously that's not the case. The Judaizers, the legalists coming in and saying, hey, we want to boast in how sinful we made you to be. No, that's not what they're talking about. It's not how sinful they could be. In fact, the legalists, the Judaizers, they wanted to live holy. They just approached holiness on the wrong basis. What they wanted was to be able to proclaim, we got you to live by our rules. We made you one of us. That's what they want to boast in. In that sense, boast in your flesh, what you can do naturally, what you can do humanly. What would happen is that the Judaizers, the legalists, the rule keepers would come along and follow the gospel message. And when somebody had come to faith in Christ, they would try to disrupt them, thinking that the right thing to do was to encourage them to keep rules. And then when they started to keep rules, typified by circumcision, they'd run back home and go, we got another one. Seven more Gentiles got circumcised today because of us. And they boasted about that because it was the rules. We got others to agree with us about the rules. Paul says that's what they boasted in. We got people to agree with our program, sign up for our plan, adopt our rules. That's what they boasted in. because that's where they lived. Humanly, naturally, in the flesh. Paul says you can tell where they live because of what they boast in. But look at what Paul says about his boast, what he celebrates, what he makes much of. Paul quickly lets us know that's not what causes him to shout, what causes him to celebrate. Rules and laws and human effort and trying harder and what we can do does not give Paul grounds for celebration. For him, there's something very different. 6:14. But far be it from me. You don't speak that way often, do you? You know? Would you like a cup of coffee? Far be it from me to... No. What Paul means is, it's inconceivable. What I'm about to tell you, it's inconceivable for me to think any other way than this. Far be it from me. When he says, far be it from me, he's telling us, fundamentally, when I look at things based on what I'm telling you, anything else would be inconceivable. Here, to him, is the grounds for boasting. He says, it would be inconceivable to me to boast in anything except the cross of Christ. The cross of Christ, all that Jesus has done, all of his work, all that he came to accomplish. Paul says, I'm celebrating, I'm making much of, I am shouting the thing that causes me to revel, the thing that grips my heart, the thing that stirs me to joyous exuberance is what Jesus did, coming into the world to rescue people out of death. What causes me to boast is what Jesus did by shouldering our sin and taking the punishment on himself that was due us. What causes me to celebrate is what Jesus did by exchanging our guilt for his righteousness. And he got what we deserved so that we can get what he deserves. What causes me to celebrate is what Jesus did by overthrowing our slavery and our sin and bringing us into genuine freedom. What causes me to celebrate is what Jesus did in procuring on his own all the blessings of heaven for those who would believe. What causes me to celebrate is what Jesus did by pouring out the rich presence and power of the Spirit into the lives of those who believe. What causes me to boast and celebrate is what Jesus did by giving us life by grace. Paul says, I can't think of anything else to boast in. Anything else would be inconceivable. Nothing else stirs me to celebrate like that does. Nothing else is worth making noise about like that is. Nothing else is worth making much of as that is. Nothing else stirs me to joyously shout as this good news. This tells us what matters most to Paul. You know what matters most to the legalists? Keep the rules. Because then when people keep the rules, they're cheering. What matters most to Paul is what Jesus did. He says, this is what causes me to cheer. In fact, when it comes down to it, there's nothing else that stirs my soul to joyous exuberance like the message and the truth and the experience and the reality of what Jesus has done. He says, far be it from me to boast except in the cross of Christ, by which the world was crucified to me and I to the world, for neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision but a new creation. He's just putting in a summary way what he's been telling us in the gospel. When he says I've been crucified to the world and the world to me, the word there, crucified, is actually formally it's a perfect tense. What that means, it's a past action that has ongoing results. It's the way that Paul spoke. The cross is something that had already happened in Paul's life. And when he talks about the world, he's talking about this. He's not talking about, I don't watch those movies anymore. I don't wear those clothes anymore. That's not what he's talking about. That may have some bearing. But the world for Paul is not about that. The world is about this system. It's about this whole way of life. Life based on what you can achieve and what you can earn and what you can work for and what you deserve. And Paul says, when the cross happened, I died to that. And it died to me. I no longer have that as my life. Because he says, neither circumcision, that sign of rule keeping, or uncircumcision, they matter not at all. What really matters is this, new life. Jesus has given us new life. He says, that's the only thing that matters. That's what I celebrate. We used to live like it was up to us. We used to live like we could earn it, we could deserve it, that what we were going to be was dependent upon what we did, like we got what we deserved. And that's how that whole system works, how the world works. And Paul goes, the cross changed that forever. It's no longer like that. We get new life. And Paul says, that's what I celebrate. That's what I boast in. Here's the idea. What you make much of, what you celebrate, what you shout about is what matters most to you. It just is. What causes a shout to rise from your lips, what draws you to your feet, what stirs your heart to beat faster, what prods you to clap, your response can tell me what matters most to you. Now, you got to hear me. I am not saying that you need to respond to the message of the gospel the way that I do. I'm not saying that your response has to be like Steve Martin on the screen, or that you have to respond like Paul does. But I am telling you this. You do boast. You do joyously celebrate that which matters most to you. You do. And if the cross of Christ is not what you boast most about, then perhaps you haven't really understood Galatians. If the message of life in Jesus is not what you most exuberantly celebrate, then maybe you just haven't understood Galatians. Perhaps the truth hasn't gripped you. Listen, Jesus came into the world to rescue you. When you weren't looking for him, when you were his enemy, he made a trip here to rescue you. He shouldered your sin and death. He got what you deserved. Although he was innocent and he took it willingly upon himself, Jesus exchanged your guilt for his righteousness. And now you get to stand in the presence of a holy God looking like Jesus by his doing. Jesus overthrew the power of sin and death in your life, so you get to live forever, ultimately free from the power of sin. Jesus procured for you all the blessings of heaven. Jesus has poured out on you and into your life the presence of his own Spirit. Jesus gave you life undeserved, unearned, unearnable. He gave you life by grace. He made you a new creation and made you acceptable to God. And Paul says, that's something to shout about. And we go, yeah. Now you got to hear me. Some of you may be asking, what's with this boasting, though, and this shouting? It sounds like so much show. It seems like so much display. But let me tell you, you have to understand that what's coming out of the letter here is the heart of Paul, and what comes out of the heart of Paul is a heartfelt expression about what matters most to him. And you can tell the magnitude of the truth by the magnitude of the response. I got word from the IRS for you. You're getting a $2 refund this year. Ooh. I got word from the IRS. You're getting a $4,792 refund. And they say they'll pay you next year if you don't pay taxes. What kind of response do you get? Yeah, big. I mean, the magnitude of the truth corresponds to the magnitude of the response. And so when Paul says, this is what I'm boasting about, nothing else can compare. Why does he say that? Because nothing else compares to the gospel. And if we're not responding in kind, maybe it's because the truth hasn't come home to us. You have to see that we will end up making much of what matters most to us. However, you might make much. I don't know how you do it. Some of you will do it differently than I. But you will boast in what matters most to you. What you make much of, what you celebrate, what you shout about. If you do that about the cross, then that glorifies God and enhances this life that we live with him. Let me explain it by quoting from Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards put it this way. This is a massive thought. It's going to take us a moment to get our heads around it. But you got to listen to what Edwards says, because I don't think this is original thought with Edwards. This comes from Paul, and Paul got it from the Spirit. So we're on good grounds as Edwards tries to explain to us why joyous, exuberant celebration is an appropriate response to the gospel. Listen to what Edwards writes. God is glorified not only by his glory being seen, but by his glory being rejoiced in. Glory is where God puts himself on display. Edwards says, God is glorified not only when who he is and what he's done is seen, but when it is rejoiced in. When those that see God's glory delight in it, God is more glorified than if they only see it. God made the world that he might communicate, and his creatures receive his glory, both with the mind and the heart. And the one who testifies his having an idea of God's glory does not glorify God so much as the one who testifies of his heartfelt praise and his delight in God's glory. What's he saying? I'm trying to think about how to get my hands around this. Edwards is saying how important it is for the truth not just to enter into our heads, but into our hearts and generate an appropriate response. It's like this. Some of you have been married for a while. And I ask you how your marriage is. And you go, I got a spouse. That's true. Affirmation of fact. And does that glorify your spouse? To a small degree. Your spouse is more appropriately glorified when, in fact, you celebrate the fact that you have a spouse and not merely declare the reality that you have a spouse. Some of us sit week after week after week in churches and we affirm, yeah, I understand Jesus died for my sins. We affirm the reality of that gospel. Yeah, I have a spouse. And there is no delight, no rejoicing, no reveling in the incredible thing that God did in taking you from death to life, taking you from enemy to friend, from taking you from being a child of wrath to a child of God. If that doesn't grip you and cause you to shout and celebrate, then I want to ask, what will? What will finally stir your heart to cheer, to celebrate? Because you know, if in fact you do not celebrate the magnitude of the gospel's impact in your life, then what you are saying is, that's good, but there must be something better out there. Ultimately, that's what you're saying. Well, I could rejoice in that, but I'm waiting for something better to come along. Some real grounds for celebrating. That's what we're saying. If it doesn't become the heart of our boast, if it doesn't become the heart of our celebration, if the gospel and the truth of Jesus' work for us and in us is not the grounds for our most exuberant celebrating, then what we are declaring is, he's not satisfying enough, there must be something else out there that'll really wind my clock and really get me celebrating. What Edwards appears to understand is that our glorifying God is more than merely the affirmation of the rightness of the gospel. But our joyously entering in to the magnificent news that because of the gospel we get life. And it is only by celebrating that we affirm that really is the thing that matters most to us. If you were to look, the Judaizers and Paul, we'd have to ask, who got the gospel right? And Paul did. How do we know? Because of what he celebrates. That's what this closing few verses is about. How do we know Paul got the gospel right? Because it's what he celebrates. He celebrates what Jesus did, not what he did. He celebrates grace, not works. He celebrates the Spirit, not natural stuff. He got the gospel right, and we can tell because it's what he rejoices in, celebrates, boasts about, exults in. Again from Edwards. This is from his book, The Religious Affections. If you ever want your world to be rocked by a biblical thinker, read Religious Affections. I started it years ago, four times. I should think myself in the way of my duty, speaking about proclaiming the gospel, I should think myself in the way of my duty to raise the affections of my hearers as high as I possibly can, provided that they are affected with nothing but truth and with affections that are not disagreeable to the nature of what they are affected with. Okay. What's he saying is, he says the truth of the gospel has to come home to our hearts. And he says my responsibility as a preacher of the gospel is to make sure that I preach in such a way that your affections, your emotions, your soul is engaged. As long as your soul is engaged with truth, and that your response to the truth corresponds to the truth. I've heard some preachers preach on the joys of heaven, but it looks like the terrors of hell on their face. That's a disconnect. They do not preach as if the joys of heaven are real to them. It hasn't come home to them. They don't boast in that. It doesn't overflow. That is not what they joyously celebrate. And I'm here to worship. But unless your heart gets engaged, and unless you, however you do it, unless you boast, unless you joyously, exuberantly let your heart be captured by the magnitude of the truth of the gospel, you're not experiencing the life God intends for you, and you are not glorifying Him the way He could be glorified. If the gospel is the thing that matters most, and you know what? I don't know how you define your life today, but your eternity is determined by the cross. Your life, where it really matters, is determined by the cross. So I don't know what you're resting your identity in or how you think about yourself, but the defining thing about you is what Jesus did, not what you do. If that's true, that ought to be the thing we most celebrate, that we get most jazzed by, most exuberantly joyful about. Oh, my goodness. Here, let me take you one place. In Book of Revelation, I think some of you are going here. I don't know all of you, so I can't say all of you are. It'd be my prayer that all of us would go here. This is Revelation chapter 5, a picture of heaven. That's why I hope that most of you are going there. Revelation chapter 5, and between the throne, this is a description of a picture in heaven that John sees. It kind of sums up what goes on in heaven. Revelation chapter 5, verse 6. And between the throne and the four living creatures, and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And the lamb went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. And when the lamb had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they began to sing a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, and you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." And then I looked, and I heard around the throne and the living creatures and the elders the voice of many angels, numbering myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing." And I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever." And the four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshiped. What are they doing? What are they doing? They're making much of what God did for you. That's what heaven will be. It won't be boring. You've been to boring parties before. This is going to be like a celebration you have never experienced. And the celebration will never end. And the joy will be overflowing. The psalmist says, in God's right hand are pleasures, joys forevermore. He has richly blessed us. And we yawn at the news. But heaven, they see it. They see what He did, and what do? That's what they boast in. That's what they celebrate. That's what they... Ultimately, you got to hear me. There's only two things you're going to boast in. You will either boast in what you do, or you will boast in what He does. That's it. That's what Paul is saying. The legalists boast in what they do, what they get you to do, what others can do. It's all about them and what they do. Paul says, it's inconceivable seeing the reality of the gospel and the grace that comes to me because of Jesus and the work of the Spirit that He has worked in me solely for His good pleasure. It is inconceivable that I would really celebrate anything else other than what Jesus has done. If we don't end up realizing that the gospel and what God has done for us in the Son and in us by the Spirit is something to shout about, if you don't realize that, I'm going to ask you, so what will you end up shouting about? What will draw a cry of delight and joy from your lips? What will raise a word of heartfelt gratitude and celebration from your soul? If not the gospel, what? If the gospel doesn't do that for you, what will? What we have been exploring in Galatians, what we have heard and what we have begun to grasp, Paul saw it, I'm just beginning to see it. What we've begun to grasp, as God has graciously opened our eyes to the wonder and the glory and the goodness and the staggering beauty of the gospel and of Christ himself and what he has done when we were undeserving and the gift of life he gives freely by his grace and the presence and power of the Spirit as our constant forever companion. When we realize that, how could we not shout and cheer and worship? That's what we're going to do. You don't have to leave. We're done earlier than we normally are, and some of you are going, I get to go early. No. We get to boast. Let's pray. Lord, for each one here, there may be a different expression of that rejoicing. But for each one that has been captured by the gospel, for each one that sees the glory of the gospel, for each one that sees the wonders of Christ, for each one that tastes your grace, the appropriate response is to joyously celebrate. Would you please move in our hearts in the next few minutes to free us to respond to the magnitude of the glorious good news of the gospel in an appropriate way. May our response fit the greatness of the good news.